Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. After 17 years, the war in Afghanistan seems to be taking a more violent turn. Taliban attacks have become more frequent, and the United States has escalated its military involvement. In 2017, the U.S. dropped over 4,300 bombs across the country, including more than 2,300 since August. That exceeds the combined total for 2015 and 2016. This is according to Air Wars, a journalist-led transparency project that monitors and assesses civilian harm from military actions in conflict zones. U.S. military hardware is also being redeployed to Afghanistan from the anti-ISIS fight in Iraq and Syria. With no end in sight to this 17-year-old war, there are so many unanswered questions. The United States has already spent $1 trillion on the invasion and the war. So what is the U.S. endgame in Afghanistan? And what will it take to bring peace to that war-torn country? In 2004, in his book Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan and Bin Laden, From the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, 2001, today's guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Steve Call, gave a detailed account of the conflict in Afghanistan from the 1979 Soviet invasion to the eve of 9/11. He's out with a new book, Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and it picks up the story from 9/11 to 2016. Steve Call is a dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University and a staff writer at The New Yorker, and he joins me here in studio. Hi, Steve. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Nice to be back.
It's great to have you back. This is a massive book. You have been reporting on Afghanistan and Pakistan for three decades. This book is almost 700 pages. With the notes, it is 700 pages. You have interviewed 500 people. You got a hold of documents through FOIA requests. I'm just looking right now at the cast of characters in this book, and it's a couple of pages long. You go deep into the weeds here. What are you hoping to accomplish from this book?
Well, it's a page turner. It's a lot of pages to turn, but yeah. I tried to write it as a lively narrative and with a lot of characters. And I guess I'm, you know, this is my life's work, as you say. A lot of this, I was assigned to the region as a newspaper correspondent for the Washington Post almost by accident. And I really spent many exhilarating years working in Pakistan and Afghanistan and kept going back. And I guess my intention with this book is to try to allow Americans who have sacrificed so much in this war, as you say, not just the financial sacrifices, but more than 2,000 dead, 20,000 wounded, many of them lost limbs, so to allow an American readership as well as an Afghan readership who suffered even more casualties, and a Pakistani readership, which has also suffered huge numbers, tens of thousands of casualties since 2001. Fighting the war that began on September 11th. So to allow all those publics to have a reliable account of how these decisions were made, why they were made, why the war went sideways, why we have been so frustrated in achieving stability and peace in Afghanistan despite all the effort.
What's really sad is because there's so much news going on right now and it's hard for people to keep up. Unless you really care about this issue, you see a headline and it's usually bombing, violence, devastation.
Yeah, even for those of us who follow it closely, I mean, the statistics that you read out are important because they're trying to have a little bit of a year-by-year perspective of where we are and what's going in the right direction and what's going in the wrong direction, I think is important, especially since, you know, we're all invested in this war as citizens, as taxpayers, and as people with, you know, volunteers who may be in the military and our families. So the big picture is that Afghanistan is becoming more unstable. The Taliban have gained influence in the countryside. There are debates in the government and from open sources, journalists and researchers, about exactly how much of Afghanistan the Taliban control. The BBC put out a survey recently that was that put their influence in the 70% of territory range. The Pentagon says it's more like a third, 25%. The CIA probably has it more like 50-50 in their classified assessments. You know, it's a tough thing to measure scientifically, but you get the picture. The Afghan government controls the cities. The Taliban control a lot of the countryside. And the war has been stalemated for a decade, and it really hasn't shifted very much in the picture that just described. The violence has gone up some in the last few years. The biggest change for Afghans is that now their security services, their soldiers and police are taking the great brunt of the casualties, tens of thousands of deaths. And it's hard to even replace the people they're losing. Mm-hmm. We're there in smaller numbers. We still take some casualties, but mostly we serve as the Afghan Air Force and drop the bombs that you mentioned at the outset.
You know, it's when you talk about these issues, it's easy to ignore the human cost of all of this. I mean, we could have an hour conversation, and I've noticed that in some conversations, the host or the reporters, they don't ask about the human toll mm-hmm. because there's so many numbers. Why have we been there for 17 years? What are the politics behind this? And that's all very important. But what would you say? Let's start off with that, the human toll of this war.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important. On the American side, I tried to write a chapter of what the fight was like on the ground at the height of our escalation of the war in 2010 in this area outside of Kandahar, where this artillery unit was converted into infantry and asked to walk through 10-foot marijuana fields and grape orchards, taking step by step, blowing up IEDs, you know, almost every 10 or 15 yards, and just how, you know, in temperatures 120 degrees, carrying 100 pounds, and losing comrades every day, and asking, you know, why are we here? What are we doing here? The strain on the military that the combination of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars created, and the difficulty they had, you know, just going out on patrol every day. You know, this kind of war by provoking contact, walking into the jungle, hoping to have someone kind of show themselves, and then getting into a firefight. I mean, it was a difficult, difficult war. It really broke and tested some of the soldiers who fought it. But then think about the Afghan cost as well. I mean, this was a country that, after all, was at peace for most of the 20th century. It didn't start this war. The Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and then Afghans rose up against that occupation. The CIA and Pakistan poured in, Saudi Arabia poured in, intensified the war. Eventually the Soviets left, then a new civil war began. I mean, this misery that Afghanistan has suffered over decades was triggered by outside interference. And even since 2001, our role in the war has not always been constructive. We've poured in money, empowered corrupt warlords, talked about creating good governance, but compromised for the sake of security. And, you know, it's remarkable that Afghans have tolerated the international community's mistakes as much as they have. It's just a sign that they really don't have an alternative other than even more darkness than what they're already enduring.
We've done a lot of shows about the history of Afghanistan, and I think it's important to revisit, because you write that it's very frustrating to hear people back home talk about Afghanistan and Pakistan as lands of warring tribes or endless conflicts they've been fighting forever. I mean, I still hear these things. And as you write, the historical record belies such cliches. Independent Afghanistan was impoverished but peaceful and stable, untroubled by radical international violence for many decades of the 20th century prior to the Soviet invasion of 1979. Its several decades of civil war since that invasion have been fueled again and again by outside interference, primarily by Pakistan, but certainly including the U.S. and Europe, which have remade Afghanistan with billions of dollars. And we can talk about that later, but
yeah.
When you look at the history, what do you think is the most interesting or the most important piece to get out there to remind people?
Well, that Afghans had their own nation, and that it was a pluralistic and poor but modernizing country. There are these wonderful photographs available from, say, the 1960s and 1970s, and maybe some of your listeners you know, were on that famous Volkswagen bus hippie trail that people used to travel from Turkey through Iran, imagine that, and then into Afghanistan. And it was secure, it was a little bit exotic, but it was a modernizing nation. And these photographs that I'm thinking of, someone collected them from some agricultural science facilities in southern Afghanistan from the 1960s and 1970s, and you have women in work, at work as technicians, as scientists, without, you know, any Islamist kind of strictures. And you had investment in agriculture and investment in light industry. And there were times when people used to go to Kabul to shop just to find some place, you know, that had more to buy than even places in Pakistan. So, you know, when the Taliban were overthrown in December of 2001 by the U.S.-led invasion, Afghans came pouring home because they thought, you know, maybe we have a chance to restore the country that was still in living memory, you know, for a lot of the adults. And they came back, and then, you know, since then, it's not all been horror. I mean, there's a generation of young people that's grown up in Afghan cities that have been, you know, rocked by the occasional bomb, but still reasonably secure. They've gone to university. They've come of age on social media. They're connected to the world. They're nationalistic. They want Afghanistan to succeed. They resent the outside interference and are trying to manage their way forward. And, you know, they deserve a chance too. So part of the heartbreak about our mistakes in the war is essentially betraying this generation's faith in our promises after 2001. Hmm.
Today we are speaking with Steve Call about his new book, Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. When you sit down to write a book like this, we do also shows about U.S. foreign policy and what is it and how does it change under different administrations. But then when you drill down and you look at Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the region, I mean, can you just talk about, do you see those as different things? Or when you do you look at the history of U.S. foreign policy when you sit down to write something like this?
Trajectory? My goal, I think the thing that I can contribute, especially as a, you know, as a journalist as opposed to a historian looking back where the records might be available, you know, 60 or 70 years after the fact, what I'm trying to do is excavate the decision-making, the mm-hmm. secret decision-making that wasn't transparent to the public, and to also put it into context, put it into order, bring it to life, bring you, the citizen, into the Situation Room so you can hear these debates and see the repeated frustration and the origins of some of the errors that you may instinctively know were made. It's sort of, one of my sources said toward the end of the project, he said, you know, this is probably the closest thing to the Pentagon Papers we're going to have for this war for a while. And that was a nice thing to say. It may be an overstatement, but that was my mission, to try to dig out, you know, all of the underground kind of intersections where this history was written. And then, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 years from now, a historian will have this set of interviews, the 550 interviews and some of the documents that I was able to acquire. And they'll be able to add to that the official archive and maybe, you know, adjust some of the history I've laid out. But it'll be a while before we have access to that kind of a record.
Mm, I mean, Daniel Ellsberg is still talking about what else was in those Pentagon Papers.
Yeah.
So many years later. As the title of your book, it's Directorate S, you're putting an emphasis on the role of Pakistan and especially its intelligence service, ISI. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how it operates?
Right. So Pakistan's main intelligence service, the ISI, has a covert action arm just like the CIA does, one that goes out overseas and does secret paramilitary operations and works with guerrillas. And that's what Directorate S is. That's the action arm of the Pakistani intelligence service. Now, it was well known to the United States and the CIA because we worked with them during the 1980s to support the Afghan Mujahideen against the Soviet forces in Afghanistan. And in fact, it was during that collaboration between CIA and ISI that ISI grew into a kind of state within the state. It was funded with, you know, billions of dollars from the United States, channeled through the CIA, but also Saudi money that came in. And ISI, you know, started to support some of the more radical guerrillas in the Soviet war, and that's where the problems that led up to September 11th began. So when we went into Afghanistan, we knew very well ISI's historical support for the Taliban and like groups. But we thought that we had persuaded them to change course and to work with us against the Taliban. Pervez Musharraf, you may remember him, the general who was the leader of Pakistan at the time of September 11th. You know, he promised the United States he would get on the U.S. side. And, you know, for a couple of years, he did help the U.S. arrest al-Qaeda leaders inside Pakistan and persuaded the U.S. that he was going to be a partner. But a couple of things started to change. In 2004, 2005, the new government in Afghanistan started to consolidate. It started to have success. We had a successful presidential election, a successful parliamentary election. And Pakistan's generals had always feared that Afghanistan would become an ally of India with support from the international system, and they started to see elements of that happening. The second thing that happened was the United States did this big nuclear deal with India, in which we essentially forgave India for breaking out of the nuclear nonproliferation regime, becoming a nuclear power. And we said to Pakistan at the same time, we're not going to do that deal for you. Mm. That gave them a pretty clear sense of where our priorities in the region were. And then finally, we were off in Iraq. You know, we got so bogged down in that war so quickly by 2004, 2005, we wanted out of Afghanistan. And in fact, we turned the security of Afghanistan over to European allies and Canada starting in 2005, 2006. The Pakistanis looked at that and they said, well, if the Americans aren't going to be here, this is going to turn messy again. And we better get our allies into the fight, meaning the Taliban. And so ISI, Directorate S, went back into action, and we in the United States and our allies in NATO really didn't see it coming until it was too late, until the Taliban were such a force on the battlefield that it was going to be very difficult to turn them back.
Most Americans first heard about the Taliban when the U.S. invaded, and the Bush administration often talked about liberating the Afghan women from the Taliban. That's the first time most Americans had heard of the Taliban. Who are the Taliban today, and how has it changed since then?
Yeah, it's a good question. The Americans in the Obama administration were trying to figure out the answer to that question. So the Taliban were a movement that came out of the resistance to the Soviet occupation. And then during the bloody civil war that followed the Soviet withdrawal, they eventually took power in the country and formed a government called the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. And they had support from Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Nobody else in the world recognized them. They were subject to sanctions because of their support for al-Qaeda in their country and also their brutal rule, including the suppression of women, keeping women out of school, and executing people in soccer stadiums on Fridays and other kinds of brutality. So that's the picture on 9/11. A problem that emerged almost from the beginning of the war after the September 11th attacks was the United States, across two administrations, could really not figure out what its theory was about the Taliban. Are they our enemy? Well, there were no Afghans on the planes on September 11th. You know, the Taliban, you might judge them to be complicit in the attacks because they accommodated al-Qaeda and they were asked to do something about al-Qaeda and they didn't before the 9/11 attacks. But it's not even clear that the Taliban leadership knew about the 9/11 plot. They certainly didn't participate in it. They've never threatened the United States outside of Afghanistan. They've never said, we're going to attack you in New York or in Los Angeles, or we're not going to, you know, they don't attack in cities in Europe the way the Islamic State does or al-Qaeda has done. And partly, also, they're embedded in Afghanistan. So who are they? After we overthrew their government in 2001, the leadership fled to Pakistan, slowly started to come back into Afghanistan. They have a ruling council, even in exile. They have maybe 25,000 soldiers. They are primarily from one ethnic group in Afghanistan, but they're part of the landscape. And I'll just finish by saying, you know, the Obama administration, when it escalated the war in 2009, the cabinet went down in the Situation Room and they kept arguing about, what are our war aims? Okay, we agree that al-Qaeda, we've got to defeat al-Qaeda because they're still carrying out attacks in Europe and trying to hit the United States. But do we really want to fight a war against the Taliban? President Obama was quite sure that he did not want to embroil the United States in a long war against the Taliban, that it was not winnable on any timeline or at any cost that was acceptable. But there were people in the Pentagon who did want to fight that war. They thought the Taliban and al-Qaeda were related to one another and that it was necessary to suppress the Taliban. But, you know, even the hawks, some of the hawks at the table had to admit, I'm not sure this is a war we can win in any foreseeable future on the battlefield. So the idea was, well, we'll hand off the war to the Afghan forces and we'll hope that they can finish it. But it hasn't happened that way.
A couple more questions about the Taliban. Why did Pakistan become a major supporter of the Taliban going back to the 90s?
Well, it's really about their neighborhood and their existential contest with India. So the Pakistani high command, the military high command, and the intelligence services, you know, they are really convinced that India is an existential threat to their country. This is part of how they justify holding power inside the country. But they also lost three wars with India, and so they have a history. And they essentially believe that they need influence in Afghanistan to keep India out, to prevent India from destabilizing Pakistan, and that the because of this history involving ISI and the CIA going back to the 1980s, they have found these Islamist clients like the Taliban, other groups like the Taliban in Kashmir, to be an effective way to keep India off balance, because they menace India, they see India as an enemy, as the Pakistan army does, and they provide a kind of way for Pakistan to try to control its neighbor, which has a huge open border with Pakistan, with lots of people coming with guns coming back and forth. The problem with this strategy that Pakistan has pursued, as many people inside Pakistan will tell you, is that it has harmed Pakistan by infesting the country with these radicals who occasionally turn against the Pakistani state or carry out sectarian terrorist attacks. It's destabilized the country. It's not a winning strategy for Pakistan. Pakistan is a modernizing country. It has a very talented middle class. What it ought to be doing is trying to normalize its relationships with India and pursue economic growth rather than using these radical militias as a source of influence. But the army is in control, and that's their strategy.
You brought up Saudi Arabia. 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, according to the official reports. The Saudis supported the Taliban, and they have a long history of establishing religious schools in Pakistan. So why isn't the role of Saudi Arabia investigated more?
Yeah, it's an important subject. I mean, they really built a lot of the infrastructure from which the Taliban arose, both by collaborating with CIA and ISI during the 1980s, supporting the Taliban during the 1990s. And, of course, they continue to support these kinds of schools and preaching networks all around the world that follow a particularly exclusionary and conservative form of Islam. After 2001, the U.S. and NATO went into Afghanistan with such force that they kind of pushed Saudi Arabia out of the front row in the Afghan conflict for a little while. Saudi Arabia then had its own struggle with al-Qaeda inside the kingdom, caused them to shift a little bit of their emphasis towards destroying al-Qaeda. But for Saudi Arabia, the main relationship in the region has always been Pakistan. The same way that China has protected Pakistan's army and intelligence service from U.S. pressure, Saudi support for Pakistan's army has also been very important. The Saudis need the Pakistanis. Pakistan has a nuclear weapons program. Saudi Arabia doesn't have one, but worries about its future with Iran, might want to access Pakistani nuclear technology. And also, Pakistan has a large population and a strong army. Saudi Arabia is always looking for help militarily because it doesn't have as strong of an army, and it's got a bunch of oil that somebody might come and try to take away. So they maintain that relationship with Pakistan for those reasons.
Today we are speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Steve Call about his new book, Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. This book picks up from his book, Ghost Wars, which gave a detailed account of the conflict in Afghanistan from 1979, the Soviet invasion, to the eve of 9/11. And this book picks up the story from 9/11 to 2016. Steve Call is Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University and a staff writer with The New Yorker. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Call, who's out with a new book, Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You might remember that Steve Call's last book, Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden from the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, 2001, got a lot of attention about that region and the U.S. involvement there. And this one picks up that story from 9/11 to 2016. And Steve Call is in town on his book tour. Unfortunately, this is a pre-taped Your Call, so we can't take any of your questions. Do you have anything else to add about Saudi Arabia, their Wahhabi ideology, what you think people need to understand? I mean, it seems like Obama to Trump to George W. to Clinton. I mean, does anything really change when it comes to U.S. policy with Saudi Arabia, other than presidents go there, they meet, they have a very close relationship?
Yeah, during the Obama administration, there was a little bit of chilliness in the relationship on both sides. Obama was tempted to try to downgrade the relationship, but, you know, for the same reason that other presidents have found themselves going back to Riyadh and paying obeisance to the king, whoever's on the throne, Obama also, in the end, tried to avoid breaking the relationship. But there was estrangement on both sides. I think when Trump came in, the Saudis saw an opportunity to intensify the relationship, and the Trump administration was led by generals and an oil executive as Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who had a lot of experience with Saudi Arabia, and they wanted to make the relationship closer and more active. But it's really a matter of degree. We are mutually dependent on one another in some respects because of the world oil economy. Mm-hmm. So there's always been a desire to stay close. But we are have been estranged around basic ideas of freedom, domestic rights, gender rights, and, you know, the role of religion in public life. Now, there's a new sheriff in town in Saudi Arabia, this young crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who's shaking everything up. And he's now announced that women can drive and that they no longer have to wear the abaya. He wants Saudi Arabia to become a tourism destination with movie theaters and things. I mean, it's a revolutionary moment in Saudi Arabia, but not a very stable one.
And we should mention that under the Obama administration, more weapons were sold to Saudi Arabia than any other president since World War II, about $200 billion in weapons.
Right. When the Saudis would say, you know, President Obama, you don't love us anymore, the American response was, well, can we sell you some more weapons from our defense industry? Mm. And they would usually say, yes, you can.
The change in leadership in Saudi Arabia is getting a lot of headlines. But what would you say about how Saudi Arabia is still influencing and supporting extremists today?
Well, the bargain in Saudi Arabia has always been between the royal family and the clergy, to use the westernized term, that is the religious establishment in Saudi Arabia. And the bargain was that the religious establishment blessed the royal family as true to Islam and as custodians of the two holy places, Mecca and Medina, and as legitimate. And in exchange, the royal family gave them lots of money and encouraged them to carry their ideas about Wahhabi Islam, which, you know, very conservative sect that dates back to the 18th century, carry their ideas abroad. And yes, some apply them at home in public life, but the real influence that Saudi Arabia has had has been through a kind of soft power in the Islamic world. They pay imams, they fund mosques, and in exchange for that funding, they print literature in many languages, they proselytize their ideas. And in exchange for that funding, they insist that the institutions that they support adhere to these ideas that characterize Islam inside Saudi Arabia.
And they're currently bombing Yemen with the support of the United States.
Yes, they're also doing that, yes. They've become much more adventurous militarily over the last two or three years, but they haven't been very effective in Yemen. They've certainly caused a lot of civilian casualties.
We need to do another show about that one. You have really interesting information in your book about 9/11, what happened prior to 9/11. You report that the United States gathered a lot of intelligence on Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. You write that the main CIA unit tasked to interact with Massoud's guerrilla was called Alec Station. Before, again, there's lots of characters in your book. Can you tell us about Massoud?
So Ahmad Shah Massoud was a legendary guerrilla fighter in the north of Afghanistan who had fought against the Soviets there and continued to fight against the Taliban, even as the Taliban really took over almost all of the country. His was among the last few redoubts, this very narrow valley called the Panjshir Valley in northern Afghanistan. And he was still at war against the Taliban and al-Qaeda, and he was one of the few people the CIA could visit and rely on in Afghanistan. They did come in secretly to try to help him identify where Osama bin Laden was. And he was assassinated by al-Qaeda 2 days before September 11th, and that's kind of where this book opens, because the loss of Massoud looked like it meant the end of the war and the Taliban's final triumph with al-Qaeda behind them. And there's this opening chapter where one of Massoud's aides calls the CIA and tells them the truth, you know, our commander is dead, and but we're going to stay and fight. We're not going to give up. Can you give us more support? Now that Massoud is gone, we need more support from you. And the CIA officer on the other end of the phone says, this is September 9th, September 10th, actually. And he says, let me consult with my colleagues and get back to you. And then the next morning, he goes into a meeting thinking about this request from Massoud, and it's the morning of September 11th. And he's in Alex Station in the basement of CIA headquarters when they see on the TV that the first plane goes in. And then they rush out to their little part of the workplace, and they get into an argument with another group that follows Hezbollah as to who's responsible for this. Is this al-Qaeda or is this Hezbollah, the Lebanese terrorist group? Finally, it becomes obvious that it's al-Qaeda. And the CIA officer who was talking to Massoud's aide calls him back, and he says, and Massoud's aide says, so you know what I mean? I see you've had a terrible attack on your country. We need just some more weapons, some more bullets, a little bit more cash. And the CIA officer says, you know, my friend, this is coming in ways you cannot imagine. Prepare your leaders. We're about to change your country. And it's the beginning of the war.
In your book, you write that the main CIA unit tasked to interact with Massoud's guerrilla was the Alex Station. Its mission was to capture or disrupt Osama bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders. The station comprised about 25 operations officers and analysts, and it was based at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. Richard Blee, an experienced operations officer from the Africa Division of the Clandestine Service, took charge of Alec in 1999. He inherited a group under rising pressure after al-Qaeda bombed American embassies in Africa in 98. CIA officers working with foreign intelligence services from Egypt to Jordan to Kenya to Pakistan conducted raids on the homes of suspected al-Qaeda members and associates from around the world. You write that they seized computer drives and documents in a number of languages, Arabic, Urdu, English, dumped those materials on Alex Station to be sifted line by line for clues. And then by 2001, the station's analysts transmitted an average of 23 formal reports per month to the FBI about al-Qaeda. The work combined high stakes with numbing details. Senior officials found that if they did not work from 7 a.m. until 6 p.m. or later, Monday through Friday, plus a few hours on Saturday and Sunday, they couldn't keep up with the traffic.
Yeah. There's also a workplace survey that I came across that was done by the inspector general, I think, or it published. He made a reference to it. And it said something like, half of every day CIA employees felt like maybe they had too much work, but two-thirds of the ones working in this counterterrorism center felt they were overwhelmed. After the book came out and the advanced reading copies and so forth, one of those 25 analysts contacted me and she said, yeah, it was as bad as you describe. Actually, the numbers were worse. We were even more overwhelmed by that. I don't know, you know, where the inspector general got their specific numbers from, but she was saying, you know, it was just a fire hose. And, you know, put this in perspective, there's a lot of what-if history about whether the CIA could have found a couple of the conspirators and broken up the 9/11 plot before it happened. And it's a painful set of questions for the CIA officers who were in that group to, you know, to reflect upon, because nobody wants to think that this thing could have been prevented but for, you know, one bit of luck or one bit of decision-making. However, you know, as you pointed out in that passage, the United States had been attacked by al-Qaeda already. We had our embassies in Africa hit. Americans had died. Hundreds of Africans had died. The USS Cole, a Navy ship in Yemen, had been struck. It almost went to the bottom. Sailors died. And yet, despite these indications of what al-Qaeda was up to, the amount of investment that our Congress and our government made in resourcing an effort to, you know, defeat this group or, you know, locate its leaders and disrupt its plotting was tiny compared to the resources of the United States government, or the, never mind, the budgets that would follow the September 11th attacks. Mm. And so I think you kind of have to put that what if in context. We really did not, 25 people at the CIA, I mean, you know, today you would find 25 people just, you know, doing the photocopy machines to support these kinds of efforts. We didn't see it coming. We assumed that it would continue to be a nuisance overseas, you know, a deadly nuisance, but the idea that they could pull off something like they did on September 11th was beyond imagination.
So that's what you conclude based on interviews with CIA officials, documents that you've looked at, that the U.S. didn't see it coming.
Well, they did see in the summer of 2001, the CIA and counterterrorism officials at the White House had enough intelligence to issue warning after warning that something bad was coming. They could hear in the chatter, you know, we're having the wedding is coming, the big wedding is coming. And it was multiple sources and very clear that the people in Afghanistan with al-Qaeda thought that they had a big one coming. And the problem was that the CIA did not know when and where, and they did not have fidelity on the specific plot. So they did go to the White House in the summer. They sent written papers to President Bush and said, you know, this is something dangerous is coming, and we need to make all efforts possible. I mean, some of Bush's aides kind of resented this form of warning. You know, they sort of said, well, you're just trying to tell us that you predicted this before it happens, but you don't have anything specific for us to do. And they said, well, no, actually, we should be more aggressive because we know something is coming. We just don't know when and where. And so that conversation kind of stalemated through the summer. And then on September 11th, it was clear what all that chatter was about.
You also write that if the U.S. would have captured Mullah Omar or killed Osama bin Laden in Tora Bora, then the war could have taken a different direction. Obviously, there's no way to know, but
yeah.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, the Tora Bora opportunity was probably the most significant one because, you know, Osama bin Laden was the leader of al-Qaeda. He was the emir of al-Qaeda. And he had drawn the U.S. into this conflict in Afghanistan in the fall of 2001 through the September 11th attacks. And there was an opportunity to finish the war. He was up on this mountainside at Tora Bora along the Afghan-Pakistan border. This was a place where bin Laden had been a fair amount during the 1980s. He had built caves and bunkers there. And the U.S. had Delta Force, special forces up on the hillside. They knew bin Laden was there. They could hear him talking on his radio. And they called in bombing, but they also knew the back door to Pakistan was open. And the debate was, should we put a blocking force up there, a U.S. force? There were Marines in the theater who could have been deployed there. There was a 10th Mountain Division Task Force in Uzbekistan that could have been deployed there, trained for mountain fighting, as its name suggests. But there was a fear that if you put U.S. troops in that, you know, in that many numbers into these villages and onto these ridges, that they would provoke an uprising, that they kind of misread the lesson of the Soviet experience in Afghanistan, and they just feared that they would have a Black Hawk Down type times 10 if they went directly into the fight. They also talked to the Pakistanis, said, can you guys block it? And the Pakistanis said, well, we need lots of helicopters. And the Americans said, well, we don't have lots of helicopters. And so there's some, you know, retrospective analysis, well, we just didn't have the logistics to make this work. But I think ultimately it was generals who were cautioned about provoking an uprising if they went in big to try to stop bin Laden from fleeing. And what happened? He went to Pakistan. He regrouped. He reconstituted al-Qaeda. He led al-Qaeda for, you know, another 10 years. And he continued this narrative. The whole story of the war was about bin Laden still out there, you know, justice isn't served. And that might have ended if the commanders had made a riskier decision.
What happened right after September 11th, 2001? The United States invaded Afghanistan on October 6th. Was there any disagreement within the Bush administration about what the response should be?
Not really. I mean, there were two debates. One was, how do we deal with the Taliban? Since we were talking about this earlier, you know, they weren't on the planes. Let's give them an opportunity to save themselves and maybe make this simpler for us. So there was an effort to send messages to the Taliban, you know, turn over bin Laden, turn over the leaders of al-Qaeda, you know, go take your soldiers, go in and knock out their training camps. You know, this is your country. If you want to save it, now or never. And there's a very interesting set of discussions that I try to document in the beginning of the book when, you know, they have these discussions. Pakistani intelligence has these discussions with Mullah Omar. Mullah Omar has them with his comrades. And, you know, a lot of his advisors, his senior kind of shura members, said to him, we don't want to lose our country for the sake of Osama bin Laden. I mean, this is not, he's not an Afghan. He doesn't do what we ask him to do. He promised us he wouldn't cause us trouble. Now, look, we're about to have the wrath of the international community come down on us. Why don't you just turn him over? And Mullah Muhammad Omar, he said, I can't serve up a Muslim guest to American justice. I just can't do it. And if it's God's will that we lose our government, then that means there is, we were doing something wrong, and we need to go into exile and reflect on what God's trying to tell us. And a lot of his advisors just went, but he was very, very stubborn and determined, and he was the absolute authority in the Taliban.
Today we're speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Steve Call about his new book, Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. His last book, Ghost Wars, gave a detailed account of the conflict in Afghanistan from the 1979 Soviet invasion to the eve of 9/11. Directorate S picks up that story from 9/11 to 2016. Steve Call is dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University and a staff writer at The New Yorker. And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. You argue, Steve, that the mission, U.S. mission in Afghanistan, was doomed from the very first day, right from the beginning.
Well, actually, I'm not sure I would say that. I would say that if there was ever an opportunity to prevent the mess that we're in from arising, it was between the time that the Taliban government fell in December 2001 and, say, 2005. Now, that was a period of relative peace in Afghanistan. Remember, after the Taliban disappeared, they fled over the border to Pakistan, and in Bonn, Germany, the international community, dozens and dozens of governments from around the world, Muslim governments, European, Asian, endorsed a new Afghan constitution. You know, we were talking earlier about how Afghanistan had been at peace until the Soviet invasion. You had all these Afghan exiles coming home thinking, we're going to rebuild our country. And they had success in the first couple of years despite underinvestment by the international community. They staged a successful presidential election. They wrote their constitution. They endorsed it. They staged a successful parliamentary election. And what happened was we turned away. We invaded Iraq. We had an ideology in the Bush administration, especially in the first term, of not nation building. So we had shattered Afghanistan yet again in the fall of 2001, but we declined to invest in reconstruction in any significant way. In 2002, 2003, we turned that over to the Europeans, but it was a half-hearted effort, and it was really not very well resourced. So the one kind of counterfactual history that I think is the most painful to reflect upon is, what if we hadn't invaded Iraq? There'd be a lot of things in the world that might be better, but one of them might be in Afghanistan, where we would have had the resources and the focus and attention to try to consolidate the success that the fall of 2001 represented.
How do you explain to people, your students, for example, why the United States got into this mess? I mean, cynics, we do shows about this a lot. You can look at the massive military budgets, the contracts that are given out on a regular basis, the revolving door between weapons companies and people at the Defense Department, for example. I mean, as someone who spent so much time on these issues, how do you answer that question?
Well, there is a machinery that you refer to. One of your colleagues was saying before we went on the air that, you know, she'd read a lot of the book and she thought, you know, this really was a story about colonial ambitions. That's certainly a way that many Afghans saw what the U.S. was doing by the time we got to 150,000 troops and a full-on war against the Taliban. And, you know, they're clearly in the story, this dispiriting succession of moments where presidents who know better, who do know better, certainly in the case of President Obama, he knew better. he nonetheless allowed the Pentagon to kind of fight its own war. There would be this debate about whether there was any military solution, and the Pentagon would say, well, there may not be a military solution in the long run, but in the short run, we've got to batter the Taliban in order to get them to the negotiating table. Sound familiar? Yes, echoes of Vietnam. And the president was skeptical about the Pentagon's plan, but felt he had little choice but to resource it. And then, as a practical matter, on the ground, our government works in such a way that, you know, almost we had 10 different wars going on at the same time. Pentagon fought its war. Special Forces fought its war. CIA fought its war. State Department ran around and tried to add some diplomatic possibilities. They negotiated in secret with the Taliban. But it wasn't coordinated. It wasn't led forcefully to try to bring whatever influence the United States had to bear on a realistic goal that would stabilize Afghanistan and strengthen Afghanistan's independent sovereignty. And, you know, in the elections, we were always trying to engineer an outcome, but at the same time, we would say, well, we don't want to interfere with the democratic process. Mm. So we never untangled these contradictions.
I just realized we have 5 minutes left. You've got so many interesting insights in your book. I just want to read a couple more passages. You write about Stanley McChrystal, who was the commander of U.S. and ISAF forces in Afghanistan, retired United States Army general. He said to his colleagues at ISAF in, I believe, 2009, the summer of 2009, "What is it that we don't understand? We're going to lose this effing war if we don't stop killing civilians."
Yeah, it's interesting. Stanley McChrystal is a famous special forces operator who had a reputation as a door kicker, you know, a really hardline special operator warrior in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it was because he had that background that he could say to his soldiers, we need to start exercising what he called strategic restraint. We need to understand that we have to support President Karzai. We can't be out killing Afghans and undermining his authority because he looks like a lackey of the United States. And this message did not go down well in the rank and file. And when McChrystal was removed because of these undisciplined comments he made or his aides made to Rolling Stone reporter the following year, he was followed by David Petraeus, who really, you know, basically rewrote the rules and emphasized, you know, hard combat and counterinsurgency in the villages, going in and knocking down doors and searching homes. And, you know, President Karzai kept saying to the Americans, you're killing me. Mm-hmm. you're really undermining my position. And they said, well, but we're supporting you. And they would say, you're the sovereign leader of Afghanistan, but then they would fight the war the way they wanted to fight it.
Speaking of Karzai, you write that in Karzai's thinking, Afghanistan was an essential prize in the new great game as the 19th century struggle by imperial powers for influence in South Asia was called. Afghanistan, Karzai thought, had now become a vital part of American schemes of worldwide power projection, a foothold for the U.S. to challenge Russia and China in the 21st century. This was an inflated, inaccurate understanding of Afghanistan's importance to the United States. Karzai was trapped by his position as the head of a weak client state, unwilling to be a stooge in an American colony, but unable to stand on his own. He also believed by the spring of 2009 that the U.S. had tired of him and wanted to remove him from power. On this point, he was on firmer ground.
Yeah, he was in a very frustrating position. And we confused him on the subject of you know, Afghanistan's place in the world, because, you know, one thing that surprised me when I went back and tried to excavate the record over time was that every time an American came to visit him, just about, he said, why aren't you doing more to pressure Pakistan? ISI is the real problem in this war. Why do you keep going around rural villages in Afghanistan? You should be focused across the border. And when the Americans failed to correct Pakistan's conduct, his thinking was, look, you guys are the world's greatest superpower. Why are you not bringing your leverage to bear? It must be that you want ISI to destabilize my country. And that's when he would say, well, but that's because Afghanistan is a fulcrum of the great game. You want military bases here for the long run. The only way you can justify having military bases is if we have a war. And so you're doing this on purpose. And the Americans would say, there's a scene where James Dobbins goes in 2013, U.S. Special Envoy, and he says to Karzai, you know, Mr. President, you have the WikiLeaks documents, you have the Snowden materials. Can you find any trace of this conspiracy that you're attributing to us? And Karzai looks at him and says, half jokingly, maybe you don't know the plan. Mm-hmm. There's a deep state in America. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is how we confuse our friends.
Mm. We could have you on the show to talk about where this goes for an entire hour. We only have about a minute left, but after writing this book and interviewing so many people, I mean, we're 17 years on. People are dying. It hardly makes news. You really have to look for it in many cases. What are your thoughts about where this is going?
Well, I worry that it's just continuing to be a stalemate and that the Trump administration's policies, while they've been adjusted in some respects, really reflect the same strategy that the Bush administration in its second term attempted and that the Obama administration attempted over 8 years. The war is stalemated. It will only end through negotiations. The violence can only be reduced through a combination of diplomacy, negotiation, and military strategy. And I don't see that three-dimensional strategy on the horizon, unfortunately.
Violent stalemate, because it seems to be getting more violent.
It is getting more violent.
Steve Call is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. His newest book is Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You might remember that in 2004, he wrote the book Ghost Wars, which gave a detailed, in-depth account of the conflict in Afghanistan from the 1979 Soviet invasion to the eve of 9/11. Directorate S picks up that story from 9/11 to 2016. Steve Call is dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University and a staff writer at The New Yorker. Steve Call, thank you for your work. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Rose. Thanks for having me.
And you can find more information about Steve's work at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Thanks for joining us. Families cramming into RVs to survive illustrate how badly California needs affordable housing. But the new federal tax plan is expected to reduce the state's housing budget by 20%. Federal budgets have neglected low-income renters for years, and new proposals call for sharp cuts to key programs. We'll ask affordable housing advocates how they plan to deal with this crisis and shrinking support from the federal government. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.